Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nick C., a host of the channel. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Roberto Carmack about his new book, Kazakhstan in World War II, Mobilization and Ethnicity in the Soviet Empire, published by University Press of Kansas. Roberto Carmack is an independent historian living in the Washington, D.C. area. He earned his PhD in 2015, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Roberto, welcome to the show.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. So I was hoping we could start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself, your educational background, and your interest in the topic of your book, World War II, Kazakhstan, and the History of the Soviet Union.
Sure. Well, I've been interested in Russia and Central Asia for quite some time. I enrolled in grad school at UW-Madison with the intent to do something with Central Asia. I just find it fascinating because Central Asia is in some ways a marginal geographic location. It's been the object of imperial exploitation and competition for 200 years. Yet it's still significant in many ways. So when I started studying Russian in grad school, I went to a few locations in Russia and Central Asia, and it became immediately apparent that the stereotype that a lot of perhaps non-academic people have about Russia, that it's mono-ethnic, that it's dominated by Russian people, it's true to an extent, but, you know, the Soviet Union and the successor states in the Russian Federation and Central Asia are very ethnically diverse. And I found that fascinating. So I wanted to learn how these kind of ethnic politics played out in practice. And I've also been interested in military history for quite some time, especially the military history of World War II. So studying Central Asia in World War II seemed like a logical choice because, as I'm sure your readers are aware, most histories of World War II that are written in the United States focus on either the Pacific, East Asian theater, or the European theaters. And that makes a lot of sense. Most of the major combat operations of the war took place in those locations, but their entire regions, like Kazakhstan and the rest of Central Asia, that were affected by the war in tremendous ways, demographically, militarily, socially. And it seemed like a great way of kind of moving the historiography a bit forward, since most of the great works that have been produced in the last 20 years, for the most part, end their analysis in the 1930s. So this was a way of satisfying my own interests and contributing to the field.
Great. And so how did you come across the idea to look specifically at Kazakhstan? You know, there are many, as you mentioned, non-Russian ethnicities in the former Soviet Union, and yet the focus of your book is specifically Kazakhstan. Is there another reason for this, or did you study the Kazakh language?
Yeah, there were a couple practical and more academically oriented reasons why I chose Kazakhstan. One, UW-Madison offered a really excellent Kazakh language program, so I put two and two together and decided to go to Kazakhstan. But Kazakhstan in particular proved to be fortuitous because Kazakhstan has a very complex history of not only imperial entanglements with the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, but the ethnic situation in the Kazakh Socialist Republic and the post-Soviet Kazakhstani state is somewhat unique because the Slavic population has been quite large since the 1890s, much larger than in other Central Asian countries like Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, or Tajikistan. So since I was interested in how these ethnicities interacted with each other and how the Soviet state kind of assessed them and tailored its policies to differentiate between them and to account for their so-called developmental differences and cultural differences, for that reason, Kazakhstan was ideal. And also, Kazakhstan is a really good place for a Westerner to conduct research. The archives there are more open than in most of the surrounding countries, with the possible exception of Kyrgyzstan, certainly more open than in Russia. Doing a military-themed research project in Russia is not impossible, but it's extremely difficult. In Kazakhstan, they're much more open. This is part of their so-called multi-vector foreign policy, where they actually want Westerners and American citizens in particular to do some research there. So it proved to be a good choice.
Great, thanks. And so you start the book by looking at the mobilization strategies of the Soviet state and the multiple institutions that were involved in that in Kazakhstan. But I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of a picture of the history of Kazakhstan up until 1941, and then kind of give us a breakdown of the process of mobilization among Kazakh soldiers in 1941 up until 1944.
Sure. So as I just alluded to, Kazakhstan was integrated into first the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union a bit earlier than the other Central Asian territories. Kazakh territories began to be annexed by the Tsarist Empire in the late 18th century. And the Kazakh steppe, starting in the late 19th century, saw a dramatic influx of Slavic colonizers. So the Kazakhs are, of course, a historically nomadic people. You know, it's a complicated question, but most Kazakhs adhere to some form of pastoral nomadism, at least partially so, until the Russian Revolution of 1917. So when the Bolsheviks came to power in both the Russian core and on the Kazakh steppe, all territories that would eventually become part of the Soviet Union, they're confronted with this novel question that fed into questions of conscription, citizenship, and other key aspects of imperial integration. And the question was simply, how do you integrate Kazakh nomads into a modern military culture? And is that even desirable? And of course, when the Bolsheviks came to power in 1917, everybody knows that they adhered to a ideology of so-called class liberation, about freeing the oppressed classes from exploitation. But they also adhere to, at least in theory, this idea of what you can call, for a lack of a better word, ethnic liberation. The Kazakhs were portrayed as victims of Tsarist colonialism, and they were supposed to be the equals of Slavs. At least that was the theory in the beginning of the 1920s. So on that basis, there was a push to integrate Kazakhs into the nascent Red Army. And this is something that their imperial predecessors weren't really too keen on. They viewed the Kazakhs as being a little bit too primitive to integrate it into the army and be effective soldiers. And here, this is, you know, this is part of what Europeans, or this is similar to what other European powers thought of regarding other indigenous peoples in places like sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, etc. So what's interesting is the Bolsheviks have this liberationist idea, but they're still being influenced by these Eurocentric conceptions. So from the 1920s to the 1930s, the Kazakhs are integrated into the Red Army in fits and starts. But by the 1930s, after the brutal collectivization of the Kazakh steppe, Stalinist authorities decide that it is desirable to integrate the Kazakhs pretty much wholesale into the military as far as possible. And this was part and parcel of this idea of including the Kazakhs and all other non-Russian peoples into the socialist project. And military service was a good way of doing this because through the military, Kazakh conscripts could learn things like the Russian language, literacy more generally, atheism, these core concepts that Soviet leaders wanted all peoples to learn who inhabited the USSR. So then we hit the war. The Germans invade in June 1941, and the Soviets are confronted with another dilemma. So they're suffering tremendous casualties in the first year or so of the war, just entire divisions being wiped out on the Western Front. Clearly, the demand for manpower was great. Yet, what my research shows is the Soviets continue to be ambivalent about this idea of Kazakh participation in the war and Central Asian participation more generally. So what my book tries to show is that, yes, Kazakhs were integrated in very large numbers, but this integration proceeded in a haphazard manner. Kazakhs were discriminated against the front, and that's why their integration into the Soviet institutions was incomplete, even though so many served on the front lines. So it was a very complicated picture in many ways.
Yeah, and so in chapter two and again in chapter four, you dedicate a lot of time to looking at wartime propaganda. Was there was the purpose of propaganda to deal with maybe some of the issues that arise because of this kind of tenuous mobilization? Or, why is propaganda so important at this time? And is it effective, what the Soviets are trying to do on the front and at home? Is this propaganda effective in raising morale, or is it serving some kind of other purpose?
Right. So I dedicate two chapters on propaganda. This is propaganda that Communist Party authorities and Kazakh propagandists developed specifically targeting both Kazakh soldiers and Kazakh laborers on the home front, that is, in Kazakhstan proper. The reason they focused so much on propaganda was because in some ways there is no other way for Communist Party authorities to conceive of the best way to disseminate communist ideology and the so-called correct ideological message. I'm sure your listeners know that, the Soviet Union was a highly ideological state. Propaganda was omnipresent, or at least it was supposed to be. So what happens in the war, and this has been an ongoing issue since the early 1920s, is on the one hand, the Soviets believe that the Kazakhs are a distinct national or ethnic group, and that propaganda should be tailored to their so-called national specificities. That means that there should be references to Kazakh national history. Propaganda should be conducted as much as possible in the Kazakh national language, etc., etc. Yet, on the other hand, especially in the 1940s, there is this competing drive to assimilate Kazakhs into Red Army culture, into Soviet industrial culture. And the issue is that this culture is by default Russo-centric, meaning that it's conducted in the Russian language, and there are many references to the dominant Russian people. So there's a contradiction there. And to me, this is important because it exposes one of the central contradictions at the heart of both Soviet nationality policies in general and Soviet policies towards Kazakhs in particular. Now, the question you raise about how Kazakhs responded to this, that's a very good one. In some ways, my book does not address the question directly because I feel as though to really do the topic justice, you have to delve into the post-war period. And that's something that historians have just recently started to do. But what became very apparent in my research is that many Kazakh soldiers, they did, at least in theory, embrace some of the ideas that were propagated through this propaganda. For example, by 1944, 1945, Kazakh propaganda especially on the front, it became highly Sovietized. What I mean by that is that Kazakh themes were eliminated from this ideological canon, but references to the pre-Soviet history of the Kazakh people, for example, were quite marginalized. Instead, frontline propagandists and, to a lesser extent, Communist Party propagandists in Kazakhstan focused more and more on Kazakh heroes from the Soviet period itself, from the Russian Civil War and from the Great Patriotic War period itself. So Kazakh people more and more began to identify with heroes from the war period, like Elia Moldagulova, for example, a really famed female Soviet fighter whose image and story was disseminated to practically all Kazakh soldiers. So you find in the post-war period, you know, these Kazakh veterans, they're articulating their identity using more Soviet terms. They're using more Russian, for example. They're referencing their feats of arms at the front, but they're still doing it in a way that's Kazakh. So you have this kind of dual identity that was consolidated during the war.
And do you think that there's maybe an issue here with, like, I'm curious why suddenly they feel the need to stop talking about pre-1917 Kazakh history. Is there some kind of worry here that bringing up anti-imperialist or anti-Russian national heroes is going to give Kazakhs the wrong idea? And then also, I think you mentioned a similar situation happening in Bashkortostan with the Bashkirs, and maybe in Dagestan as well. So is this a kind of pan-Soviet phenomenon happening, or is there something specific about Kazakhstan on this regard?
It would be best to describe it as a pan-Soviet phenomenon. So, you know, the history of Kazakh opposition to Russian imperial rule is a long and bloody one. The Kazakhs were, under the Tsars, a colonized people, and like most colonized peoples, they resisted it sometimes very bitterly. At first, and here I'm talking about the early 1920s, Soviet authorities actively cultivated this historical and ideological emphasis on the so-called Kazakh national liberation struggle, because for them, this was a good conceptual cudgel to bash their Tsarist predecessors with. But in the 1930s, the situation starts changing. Other historians, especially David Brendenberger, have described how the Soviet ideological establishment takes this very strong Russo-centric turn in the mid to late 1930s. At this point, the Bolsheviks begin to decide that, listen, it's not good to cast aspersions on the Russian people, even if you're referring to the 19th century, because the Russians are the dominant people of the Soviet Union. They're the glue that's holding everything together. But then something interesting happens during the war. Some of this emphasis on the Kazakh national liberation struggle and other national liberation struggles too, such as in Bashkiria or in Dagestan, it starts to re-enter the picture a little bit. And this is because the early period of the war, I'm talking about the first 1 to 2 years in particular, when the situation of the front was extremely precarious and unstable, during this time, there was a willingness on the part of local propagandists in the non-Russian republics and in Moscow to experiment a little bit. So some permission was granted to kind of re-explore these topics. And this information was disseminated to Kazakh soldiers at the front because this was seen as a good way of inspiring them by reminding them that their ancestors were, effective soldiers, that they were brave, et cetera, et cetera. But then, yeah, you're right. In 1944, 1945, the ideological establishment snaps back to the 1930 status quo, where again, there's this worry that, you know, you can't focus too much on this so-called anti-Russian discourse because it would threaten the dominant position of the Russians in Kazakhstan, in Bashkiria, in other non-Russian republics. So this is, again, a return to the status quo. This was done because the Soviet leadership felt that they were secure, that they didn't need to inspire Kazakh soldiers to such a dramatic extent as before, because the situation at the front was a little bit more propitious for the Red Army.
And I'm interested because you spend a lot of, you know, in chapter two, you're looking at propaganda on the front. And then I think in chapter four, you're more looking at propaganda in wartime Kazakhstan. First of all, I'm curious, like, what kind of sources you were using to explore this? Are you looking at the agitprop workers themselves? Are you reading newspapers? How do you get a sense for what kind of propaganda was being used? And then also, like, how do you gauge the response of either Kazakh citizens or of soldiers on the front? And then finally, do you see any major differences between the kind of propaganda being conducted on the front as compared to kind of the home front back in Kazakhstan?
Sure. So the main sources I looked at were Communist Party documents, especially the agitprop section of the Communist Party of Kazakhstan. This was really helpful because, you know, the Kazakh Communist Party was obviously involved in ideological production at the front and in Kazakhstan. So if you're talking about the front and Kazakhstan proper, it's important to differentiate between the two main institutions involved. At the front, there was the main political administration of the Red Army. This was actually a party body that was responsible for ideological indoctrination among Red Army soldiers. So in addition to Kazakh Communist Party documents, because there's a lot of correspondence between the main political administration and Communist Party bodies throughout the Soviet Union. In addition to those administrative documents, I looked at some memoirs. There is one very prominent Kazakh Communist Party worker. His last name was Amanjolov, and he occupies a prominent place in the second chapter of my book. He not only wrote propaganda, he wrote memoirs about his experiences as a pretty high-level propagandist, but he produced propaganda itself, and I was able to acquire a book of his zapiski, his notes, lectures that he conducted at the front about any number of themes, and reports to central party bodies where he complained about the deficiencies in propaganda. And as you can imagine, there were many. It was very hard to tailor propaganda for Kazakh soldiers in practice because of a lack of resources, difficulties with translation. The list goes on and on. And when it came to looking at the propaganda itself, I focus a lot of my attention not only on lectures that were conducted at the front and in Kazakhstan, but also at newspapers, because Communist Party authorities saw newspapers as a prime means of disseminating their message. Not only were these newspapers sent to the front and to kolkhozes or collective farms in large numbers, but they were read aloud. This was one of the major mediums for propagandists to get the word out. So I spent a lot of time in the Central State Archive of Kazakhstan, going through frontline and Kazakhstani newspapers. I looked at many titles, something like 10, and looked at the dominant themes, focusing on topics that were unique to Kazakhstan, because as you can imagine, there was a lot of sharing of information between central newspapers like Pravda and Izvestia. A lot of the stories were reproduced wholesale for Kazakhs. But then there is a small corpus of materials that was exclusively in Kazakh. And there you can kind of see different themes emerge. To get to your last question of how Kazakh soldiers reacted to this propaganda, it's a pretty difficult question to answer because for the most part, I did look at Communist Party investigations of how Kazakh soldiers reacted, but these were very formulaic. They mainly said that, you know, Kazakh soldiers are inspired, that they enjoy hearing about their homeland, about their national history, etc. But I didn't find these very satisfying from a methodological standpoint. So I tried to look at other memoirs to kind of read between the lines and see how Kazakh soldiers might have reacted. But really, The proof of this is in the post-war period and subsequent decades, when Cossack soldiers focused on ideas that, in my opinion, first found their way into the popular imagination through propaganda. For example, my original idea was to interview a lot of Cossack veterans of the war, and I did do that, but I found that these men and women are quite old now, and most of their reminiscences, they adhered almost exactly to the propaganda that was produced during the war, almost word for word. And in a way, that shows you that propaganda, at least in the long term, did have quite the effect in imprinting itself on the minds of its recipients.
That's really interesting. I didn't expect that, and I'd like to talk maybe later on more about your process of interviewing those individuals. But I wanted to kind of shift the conversation a little bit to the third chapter of your book, in which you actually look at the home front, or kind of the labor front in Kazakhstan, and you look at labor mobilization, because for me, this is a really unfamiliar part of the story. You know, we're used to hearing about soldiers and serving on the front, but actually you paint what is a pretty grim picture on the home front. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what kind of labor mobilization is happening in Kazakhstan during the war. What are they producing, and how does this fit into the bigger kind of picture of the Soviet economy during war?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. So I decided that a chapter on labor mobilization was definitely needed because, a lot of Soviet histories are confined to the Western Front of the war. That would be the Eastern Front for a Western audience. But, labor was an integral part of the war, and I found enough documentation in these various archives to really tell a compelling story about it. So there were many kinds of labor mobilization that took place, and there were some that were general to the Soviet Union, some that were unique to Kazakhstan. In general, in Kazakhstan, the emphasis was on producing foodstuffs on collective farms. Kazakhstan, for a long time, had been a primarily agricultural republic. That had started to change during the 1930s and the 2 5-year plans. So some focus was placed during the war on producing steel and other raw materials that could be refashioned into war material, especially in factories in places like the Urals. But the focus was on raw industrial and or foodstuffs. So the question is, how did Soviet authorities manage to up production, even though the population of the republic went up and down during 1941, 1942? It certainly went down because Kazakh soldiers were leaving for the front, not just Kazakh soldiers, but Russian inhabitants of the republic too. So immediately the workforce is being depleted. And that was compensated for quite a bit by the arrival of deportees and evacuees who started to arrive in 1941 as well. But here you have, as you said, it's a grim picture because Soviet authorities, in typical Stalinist fashion, decided that the best way to up production was simply to increase coercion. So one of the main means of mobilizing these people for work was forced population movements. For example, to up agricultural production, city dwellers in places like Kostanai or Shymkent or Almaty were forcefully moved from the cities to the countryside to farm. In addition, one of the perhaps worst forms of labor exploitation that took place was the so-called labor army. The labor army was this highly militarized network of essentially prison camps that were very similar to the Gulag in most respects. And this was an institution where non-Russian national minorities were kept in horrible conditions. They felled timber, they worked on construction sites and mines. And here, the dominant populations were, on the one hand, mobilized Central Asians who were either too infirm or physically unable to fight at the front or because they had suspect political backgrounds, and also Soviet German deportees. These were deportees from mostly the European parts of the Soviet Union who were deported in the fall of 1941 to various punitive or perhaps not punitive, but various repressive institutions in Kazakhstan and other eastern regions where they were forced to work with inadequate food. So labor exploitation in general, and this is one of, I believe, the major contributions of the book, it disproportionately affected non-Russian peoples, Kazakhs, and especially deportees.
Yeah, and this is, I think this is kind of one essential part of your argument, is that wartime kind of, if not creates, exacerbates these kind of national hierarchies. And I think you get to that even more in that fifth chapter, which looks at the deportations of not just the Volga Germans, but also different nationalities from the Caucasus. And I was curious, is this something new? Is this a new story? Because I'm at least familiar with the deportations from the Caucasus, and I think those have been talked about for some time. But how do you see, what do you bring new to this story? And is it the sources you had access to? I know you were able to work with some NKVD documents. Or is this kind of a familiar story told in a new light? Or I was curious about your decision to bring the deportations into the broader story.
Right. So, yeah, the deportations have been examined quite a bit, especially the Soviet German deportations, because German scholars have done a pretty excellent job of producing secondary works on that topic. Source-wise, yeah, I have a lot of NKVD documents that their ultimate origin is Moscow. I also looked at a lot of documentation in Almaty. Part of the contribution here is the focus on labor exploitation, because some works, for example, Catherine Yolok's book on Polish deportees, and Michaela Pohl's work on North Caucasian, especially Chechen deportees in Kazakhstan, do focus on labor exploitation. But the issue with these really excellent secondary works is that, you know, they don't focus much on the war period itself. They take most of their focus and place it on the immediate post-war period and subsequent decades. But I believe it was important to focus on the war period because the situation of these deportees is really important for understanding the changing ethnic hierarchy that took place or that was consolidated in Kazakhstan during World War II. And this is something that you've already alluded to. This is one of my key arguments, that the war itself helped consolidate this new ethnic hierarchy within Kazakhstan. And what I mean by that is basically Slavic peoples were on top, and this is not a new argument. People have been pointing this out for the Soviet Union as a whole for some time. But it's really when you bring in officially repressed groups like the Chechens and the Soviet Germans where you can see the contours of this hierarchy in a new light. For example, deportees were treated worse because they were associated with treason. This was very different from how Cossacks were treated. Cossacks were also mistreated at the front, in the labor army and in other institutions, but it was for a different reason. It was because Soviet authorities had this implicit notion that Cossacks were developmentally backward, that they were culturally deficient compared to Russians. That was bad, of course, but you don't really see these murderous policies applied to Cossacks and other Central Asians that you do towards deportees. And the reason is because in the Stalinist Soviet Union, to be primitive or to be considered primitive was a bad thing, but to be considered treasonous by dint of one's nationality, that was worse, that was disastrous. And it was only by bringing in the deported peoples into the story where that difference comes into really sharp relief.
And what that tells me is that in general, you're also interested in thinking more broadly about World War II as a transformative period for Kazakhstan. And I was curious because you have this chapter, on the Kazakh wartime economy, and you know we have Sarah Cameron's recent book on the basically. Huge changes in agricultural production and the famines in the 1930s. Is the wartime experience equally transformative as the 1930s were for the Kazakh economy? I mean, did you get any sense of what happens in the post-war period, or is that a bit beyond the purview of your book?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The short answer is no. It wasn't as significant as, for example, the forced sedentarization and collectivization of the Kazakh population during the early 1930s. I would argue that it's best to view the war as sort of the capstone in a long chain of historical events that led to Kazakhstan's integration into the Soviet Union. First, we have the October Revolution, then forced collectivization during the 1930s, industrialization during also the 1930s, and then the war from 1941 to 1945. In the grand scheme of modern Kazakh history, collectivization was more significant. It completely changed the Kazakhs' demographic structure. This terrible famine killed well over a million Kazakhs, destroyed their nomadic way of life, which was one of the key aspects of being Kazakh in the first place, was adherence to this at least partially nomadic mode of life. So in that respect, the war sort of contributed to this ongoing official effort to force the Kazakhs to think in a Soviet way and to act in a Soviet way. And, you know, some of the processes that were laid down during the war and that actually began during the 1930s do find expression in subsequent decades. For example, the war, it becomes very clear that Soviet authorities are more than willing to heavily exploit the Kazakhs to achieve their military slash strategic objectives through conscription, through exploitation of the labor army. After Stalin dies in 1953, this is less significant, or at least less severe. But you still see this phenomenon where Soviet leaders, even under the more liberal Khrushchev or Brezhnev, still see the Kazakhs as a somewhat inferior group compared to Russians, and thus they are seemingly more willing to exploit them. And here you have, as a good example, the use of Semey province in northern Kazakhstan as a nuclear testing ground, where severe damage was done to the local Kazakh population.
Yeah, and I'm curious too, if we're just talking about kind of like the legacy of the war, what happens to these deported peoples who are, I mean, do they remain in Kazakhstan? Is there any attempt to later bring them back to the Caucasus or to the Volga region? I mean, would we go there and find the descendants of these people today, or?
After the war, there's this effort to integrate the deported peoples into local society. during the war itself, this was very difficult because party state authorities, to a degree, and definitely the deportees themselves, do not really believe that the deportations will be a permanent thing. This starts to change in subsequent decades, but you still have this undercurrent of resistance to the deportation measures. And groups like the Chechens and Soviet Germans arguably never really believe that their proper homeland is Kazakhstan. And under Khrushchev, this pressure, along with other kinds of pressure that came about because of ethnic conflict, for example, become quite severe. And because of petitions from these deported peoples, at least the North Caucasians, Soviet leaders do relent and allow the North Caucasians to return to the Caucasus and to restore their homelands. The situation for the Soviet Germans was worse. The Volga German Republic, from which most of the Soviet Germans were deported from, was never restored. And as a consequence, most of the Soviet Germans actually leave the Soviet Union entirely once the emigration regime is liberalized in the post-war period, and they go predominantly to West Germany. If you go to Kazakhstan today, there's still a small Soviet German population. They're considered one of the constituent ethnic elements of the modern Kazakhstani Republic. And of course, there are still Chechens and other North Caucasian groups that either remained in Kazakhstan throughout the 70s and 80s, or that had to return to Kazakhstan, in a sense return, because of the Chechen wars of the 1990s and early 2000s, where sadly, Kazakhstan became much safer than Chechnya, and they already had these established familial and clan networks to rely on.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to turn the conversation a little bit here because I recall now that during the war, another kind of I see repeatedly that 1943, and this makes sense if we think about the history of the war, but 1943 is a big turning point in your narrative too. And I'm thinking specifically about kind of the return of religion, if we want to call that. In that chapter 4 on propaganda, you also talk about kind of the official recognition of Islam in 1943. And I think this happens at the same time that Stalin makes some concessions about the position of Orthodox Christianity in the Soviet Union. Could you tell us a little bit about that? I think these are mostly institutional processes, but is this a real return of Islam, or is it kind of what function does it serve, and why does this happen in 1943?
Right. So the question of the role of Islam in the wartime Soviet Union is a quite controversial one. In addition to my own writing, Aaron Tassar has written about this quite a bit. And there's been a pretty concerted debate in the literature about what this so-called return to Islam actually meant in practice. So the Soviet Union always had a very difficult relationship with Islamic belief and Muslim believers. In some ways, Soviet authorities treated Islam like it did Russian Orthodoxy and other religious groups. They viewed Islam as an undesirable vestige of the past, as reactionary, and as anti-Soviet. And from the revolution to World War II, this kind of attitude ebbed and flowed. By the late 1930s, during the so-called Great Terror, religious authorities in Central Asia were subjected to just brutal persecution. And officially sanctioned Islam at that time, it didn't cease to exist, but it was extremely hobbled. It couldn't do much in the way of influencing Islamic life. And these unofficial Sufi orders that operated in a sort of clandestine realm in places like Kazakhstan especially, they continued to exist. But anyone that Soviet authorities considered to be associated with Islamic belief were apt to be persecuted, arrested, and possibly killed. So, as you mentioned, during the war, something happens, particularly in 1943. The Soviet Union conducts what I would describe as a turnaround in its policy. First, the Russian Orthodox Patriarchate is reestablished, and the Patriarchate is turned into a major institutional ally of the Soviet state. The Orthodox Church is conducting propaganda on behalf of the Soviet state, not Marxist-Leninist propaganda. This is religious propaganda. But the goal is to increase the zeal of Orthodox believers to prosecute the war. And something similar happens in Central Asia. Stalin gives an order to relent pressure on the official Islamic establishment. And in Central Asia, it's split into the spiritual administration of the Muslims of Central Asia and Kazakhstan, or SADUM. That's the acronym. And I would argue that, you know, it's important not to overstate what this meant in practice. This doesn't mean that the Soviet Union all of a sudden believed that Islam and Islamic belief were positive things. It didn't. This was more of an instrumental way of garnering support from the war effort. I think here there's an implicit acknowledgement by Soviet authorities that Marxist-Leninist propaganda, even in its Kazakh variant, may not have been very effective, especially among poor Kazakh aul or village dwellers. They needed something else, and focusing on the spiritual administration was a logical choice. So what this meant is that they were paying the spiritual administration more money. They were allowing it some latitude in conducting religious services for the population. So this is best described as an alliance between the spiritual administration and the Soviet state to prosecute the war effort. So at first, it's a mobilizational effort. That's the end goal. And then later, Sadun becomes a permanent fixture of life in Central Asia. And this is mainly done so the Soviet Union has institutional means to interface with local Muslims to maintain a degree of control over local Muslim religious life.
Yeah, and I think that point, you know, the this question of Islam and the debates that surround it kind of raises another point about the memory and the legacy of World War II in post-Soviet countries today. And I was curious, I'm not sure this is something you get at directly in the book, but having spent a lot of time in Kazakhstan, I'm sure you've talked about these topics with people quite a bit. I'm curious how you think like the average Kazakh today would think about the narrative you're putting forth in the book. You know, maybe the story about the wartime front would be familiar, but is the history of the home front and the rationing and this kind of very extractive, exploitative labor regime, is this in the public consciousness, or would this be seen as a kind of controversial narrative in Kazakhstan today?
Yeah, it would be a controversial narrative for the most part. So when I first arrived in Kazakhstan, I started doing research in archives, and you know, you tell the archivist or the librarian about the topic. I would say Kazakhstan during the Great Patriotic War, and they'd be like, well, that makes sense. That was a big topic. Americans must be interested in Central Asia's role in the war. And I said, you know, for the most part, we haven't been. It's kind of a blind spot in our history, in our historiography. And they would be shocked. They would say, how could this be? It was so important for us. And I'm like, well, that's why I'm trying to write it. But you know, reading post-Soviet Kazakhstani text on the war, it's remarkable the extent to which Soviet themes, Soviet ideas, and Soviet narratives continue to pervade the scholarship. In some ways, they're virtually identical. There's a strong emphasis on the patriotic sacrifice that Kazakh soldiers made on, yes, labor mobilization and the efforts of collective farmers and industrial workers to contribute to the victory. And here it's fundamentally similar to the kind of themes that pervade Russian historical works about the war. Yes, it's starting to change a little bit. For example, the new official history of Kazakhstan in its chapter on the war has a small section on the deported groups discussing how the war led to their deportation, how they contributed to the war with their labor, but for the most part, You know, this was a dark period in their history. But, you know, this idea, for example, that Kazakhs were discriminated against during the war, that they were subjected to the horrors of the labor army, this is something that many Kazakhs, I would predict, wouldn't be too keen to hear, because there is this perception that that takes away from the more heroic narrative of fighting at the front and so-called courageous labor on the home front. So yes, it is controversial because it does significantly depart from still dominant Soviet narratives.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting because, you know, it's kind of a good reminder that actually both of these narratives can kind of exist, and that the war experience meant a lot for different groups of people, and that, you know, it's probably, it just introduces this complexity that maybe we sometimes miss. And so on that note, I kind of want to give you a chance to kind of step back and tell us kind of what are the bigger picture kind of takeaways that you have from your book. What is this, what does your research tell us about Soviet Empire? What does it tell us about kind of ethnicity in the Soviet Union, or kind of the, as you put it, the creation of national hierarchies? What are the main points you want the reader to take away with this project?
Sure. So one of the, I'd say the primary argument of the book was that the war altered the nature of inter-ethnic relations in Kazakhstan. And it did this, at least in part, by sort of shifting the parameters of inclusion and exclusion. And these parameters shifted in accordance with the mobilizational goals of the Soviet leaders. So here I was looking at how the Soviet regime's nationality / ethnic policies interface with their mobilizational policies. And like I mentioned before, what becomes very clear by 1945 and the end of the war is that this ethnic hierarchy is firmer than it had been before the war, with Russians and other Slavs up top, Central Asians in the middle, and deported groups who arrived in Kazakhstan from 1941 to 1945 at the bottom. And this is important because, you know, here you find a way to assess how non-Russian national minorities like Kazakhs or even deportees assess their role in the Soviet Union and in this so-called ethnic hierarchy. You know, I found, for example, that after the war, Kazakhs, and you can say the same about other Central Asian groups like Kyrgyz or Uzbeks, they started to frame their identities, at least in part, by referencing their close proximity to so-called traitorous groups like Soviet Germans, Chechens, and others. And this was done, in my opinion, intentionally. They were trying to compare themselves favorably to these so-called traitorous groups to underline their own Sovietness, to underline the fact that they were patriotic peoples. They insist, for example, well, we fought in the war, we fought at the front, whereas the Soviet Germans did not. But the ironic part is, of course, is that it was Soviet policies themselves that permit Kazakh veterans and others to engage in this kind of discourse, because it was the Soviet Union, or excuse me, the Soviet regime, that ultimately decided to send the Kazakhs to the front, although they did so in a kind of inconsistent manner. And it was Soviet authorities who kicked the Soviet Germans and other repressed groups out of the army. So it's a fascinating way of looking at how national minorities use state policies to articulate and buttress their own identities as Soviet peoples.
Well, thanks. Thank you for that. And I think we're nearing the end of our time here, but as is custom, I usually like to ask our guests if they're working on any current projects, or if they have any kind of projects, future projects in mind that we should be looking out for.
Yeah, so right now I'm very interested in this, the historiography of the Great Famine that occurred on the Kazakh steppe in the early 1930s. As you mentioned, Sarah Camera has just written a very good book about this topic. With Sarah Cameron's book, Robert Kindler's recent book, we have a pretty good idea of the dynamics of the famine, the consequences of forced collectivization, etc. So I would be interested in writing sort of a military history of forced collectivization on the Kazakh steppe, because, you know, collectivization was accompanied by large-scale rebellion on the part of former Kazakh nomads resisting the imposition of Soviet control in the steppe, food requisitioning, forced collectivization, etc. And other historians like, other historians have written about this topic. Niccolò Pianciola, that's the name I was thinking of, has written some good work about this. But there's so many questions that are related to the military aspects. How did ethnicity play a role in the suppression of these revolts? How come Soviet authorities didn't rely on Kazakh conscripts? Was it just a question of loyalty? These difficult questions, but important ones. How did Kazakh rebels, how on earth did they manage to field these guerrilla forces when they were starving to death? These questions beg answers, in my opinion. So that's something that I would like to work on in the future.
That sounds great. And we'll hopefully look forward to your second book. And you can come back and give an interview again. So thank you again, Roberto, for sitting down and going into great detail about these very important topics. And for the listeners, once again, if you liked what you heard and you want to read more, the book we were discussing is Roberto Carmack's Kazakhstan in World War II, Mobilization and Ethnicity in the Soviet Empire, published by the University Press of Kansas this year. So thank you again, Roberto.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it.